stuff.
Blog Talk Radio.
Friends, you're listening to The World Transformed on the Blog Talk Radio Network. The World Transformed is an audio production of Speculist Media. You can find us online at worldtransformed.com. This program explores a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which are at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And The World Transformed is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. We're not here so much to tell you about the future as we are to encourage you to think about your future and to consider what may be the biggest transformation of them all, the one that occurs in your life, in your world, the one that begins with recognizing and acting on the vast possibilities that are unfolding before you and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does that amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. We're back in the world, huh?
That's right. We had some serious technical difficulties last week. It was the first time, and I don't know how long, in years, that we actually had a show just completely crater on us because of technical difficulties. And it appears, knocking on wood, that those problems have been taken care of by Blog Talk Radio. So we are hopeful that won't happen again.
So far, they seem to be back up and running. We've been on this service for 5 years, and they've been in beta the whole time. As far as I know, they're still in beta, which I think is a really, really clever strategy on their part. But one of the things we say is that every week we say, well, there's a glitch each week. Every week we look forward to our technical glitch, and that'll be the glitch of the week. And last week's glitch was, just happened to be a show killer. So through synchronicity and good fortune, it turns out that we can make lemonade out of that lemon, because that additional week gave us time to round up a couple of fantastic guests that we have on tonight to talk about the topic that we were going to talk about last week. And one observation about this, Stephen, we said at the beginning of the year that we were going to try to have a guest on every other week, but it seems like what we're actually doing is we're having two guests on every 3 weeks. Isn't that about how it's working out?
Well, and the interaction of our guests is always awesome. So,
absolutely. Well, it's always fun to have as many on as possible. But we were talking last week about the piece that George Dvorsky had written over at IO9 about how we'll probably never upload. And I was going to take the George case, and you were going to take the Ben Goertzel response case. But we thought, hey, we got an extra week. Let's see if we can get these guys on. And sure enough, Ben is available, so we're going to have him on this evening. And George didn't want to do it, but he suggested that we talk to David Pierce, who had actually helped him out with writing that particular article, and who is someone that we've been meaning to reschedule after we had technical difficulties the first time we tried to have him on the show. So wonderful confluence of things here this evening. We've got two fantastic guests. I'm going to go ahead and introduce them. Let's start with David Pierce. David is a vegan activist, and he's the author of The Hedonistic Imperative, an online manifesto urging the use of biotechnology to abolish suffering throughout the living world. In 1998, he co-founded with Nick Bostrom the World Transhumanist Association, which we now know as H+. And, of course, transhumanists believe in using technology to overcome our biological limitations. David, welcome to The World Transformed.
It's very good to be with you.
Well, we're super excited to have you with us. Sorry it took us a while to finally get you back on the schedule, but I appreciate your flexibility in being on so quickly this week.
Well, it's as I said, it's the connectivity is likely to be better in the U.S. too, so hopefully there won't be any hiccups.
Yeah, well, you know, figure we get you while we had you in a handy time zone for sure. And speaking of handy time zones, our other guest is coming to us from the Far East tonight. No stranger to this program, Dr. Ben Goertzel is the chief scientist of Ben. I'm going to take a shot here. Is that pronounced IDEA?
There you go, IDEA.
IDEA, yeah, it's like an interesting spelling of IDEA, Limited, a Hong Kong-based company using AI technology for financial prediction. He is the leading researcher in the area of AI called Artificial General Intelligence, or AGI, and he leads the OpenCog open-source AGI initiative. Currently, he's working with David Hansen to use OpenCog to control intelligent humanoid robots. That is awesome. He also works on applications of AI to life extension biology. He's written over a dozen books and over 100 papers on his research, and has been active in the futurist movement with roles at Singularity University and Humanity Plus. Ben, always a pleasure to have you with us.
Well, thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. Well, gentlemen, we're going to jump right into this. Now, I'm going to set a few just thoughts about how we might approach this, since the piece that that appeared in IO9 kind of got the whole thing started, and it has a list of what George described as, I think there were eight of these reasons that we'll probably never upload. So one of the things I want to mention is that it is written as probably, that there's no statement here that it absolutely can't happen, but these are reasons why it probably would never happen. And I'm going to say that of that list, if this is acceptable to everyone here, the last three, uploaded minds would be vulnerable to hacking and abuse. We can never be sure it works, number seven. And number six, it would be unethical to develop. Those aren't actually reasons why it can't happen. Those are reasons maybe why we shouldn't, or why people would be cautious, or why we'd need to be extra careful about doing it. But they're not reasons why it can't happen. So I'm going to move those off the agenda, and we'll talk about the other ones, if that's acceptable to both of you.
Well, Phil, I think that the objection, we can never be sure if it works, it's kind of part and parcel of some of the earlier objections. I just see that as part of the complaint that we don't understand what consciousness is fully and how it relates to the body. Whereas the other two objections, as you pointed out, are not really objections to it happening, but they're objections of the form, well, it might be trouble if it does happen. So I agree with two out of three of your dismissals there.
Okay, and we'll keep the other one. Is that okay with you, David? Does that work for you?
Yes, indeed. I mean, there's the old philosopher's problem, skeptical problem of other minds. How do we know each other are conscious? Is the question of uploading no more interesting than this general skeptical worry, how do you know other people are conscious? Or does it raise profoundly different and more challenging issues? I think that's one way of not wholly dismissing, but not considering that issue of how can we be sure here.
Well, that's a great way of putting it. And in fact, I thought about removing the one about the hard problem of consciousness only because, Stephen, don't we talk about that every other week anyway? Because it seems like that's like the That is a topic that constantly comes up on this program. But that's great. We'll push through on that one, and we'll resolve it tonight, okay? We've got two great guests on, so you can,
absolutely.
You can solve that one for us once and for all, and we can find something new to talk about in weeks to come. Okay, so with about, what have we got, Stephen, about 47 minutes remaining in the program, I'm going to do my best to keep us on track for those six that we've decided we'll talk about, and we'll just jump into this first one. Brain functions are not computable. Now, what if they're not? Then, David, can you say something to characterize what this objection is? What does it mean for something not to be computable?
There is a school of thought, particularly associated with Roger Penrose, a brilliant mathematical physicist, that says that brains have this capacity to do something that ordinary classical digital computers cannot do. Now, without going into a long speculations on quantum mechanics, the consensus is that organic robots are nothing special. We are not in any way unique or privileged. And the consensus, such as it is that that there is nothing non-computable that our minds can do that could not be emulated, in principle at least, by a classical digital computer. Now, I have one or two reservations here, but perhaps Ben could say a bit more.
Mm. Well, yeah, I mean, the idea that the human brain might be a non-computable system that can't be modeled using computers really seems to me more of a theological than a scientific complaint, in the sense that there's no scientific way to prove that true or false. The collection of all scientific data ever gathered is a gigantic, finite collection of finite precision numbers. So all scientific data is one big finite bit set. And if your data is a big finite set of bits, you can always model that data using some computational model. So all data we now have and all scientific data we will ever have about the brain could be explained by some computational model. Now, you may say you prefer to model this finite data using some kind of infinite set theoretic model that goes beyond Turing computation. And Selma Brinks-Jord at RPI talks about trans-Turing oracles going beyond computing. And he's also a devout Christian and believes that God can go beyond computation and do things that we just can't imagine and that we can't measure using science. So, I mean, of course, we can never know anything for sure. That's the nature of science. You're always uncertain and trying to approximate better and better knowledge without ever getting to an absolute truth. So you could never reject a hypothesis like the mind isn't computable. But I don't think it's not a scientific hypothesis. It's a statement that scientific data will nevertheless understand the mind. And as a hypothesis, I don't see any reason to adopt that one.
It seems, Ben, just clarify one thing you said. It as far as whether it could be proved or disproved, it seems it could definitely be disproved by computing a brain, right? I mean, if you actually did model a brain and have it work.
Well, not exactly. If you really want to become a philosopher, I mean, what if there was some non-computable soul that was hovering out there in soul space that attached to itself to any computer program that achieved a certain level of functionality? Then once you program the right software, then the soul would attach itself to that software, and the soul would still be a non-computable thing.
Huh, okay.
So, I mean, there's a lot of out there hypotheses you could...
Metaphysical arguments then, really, yeah.
But, I mean, it's not... Those are not the simplest hypotheses to my mind. On the other hand, if you're coming at it as a devout Christian, those may be the simplest hypotheses. And to me, I just want to focus on, as a researcher, the functionalities, the behaviors that an AI is going to achieve. And I don't see any behaviors that we need an AI to achieve to be human-like or greater that we can describe in some finite way as some computable list of behaviors. So I don't see why it's necessary to go there. And the other thing I would say is, if we do need to go there, if we need to go to modeling minds as fundamentally non-computable systems, what that means is the whole paradigm of modern science in terms of finite precision measurements is broken and needs to be replaced by something that goes beyond science, in the same way that science goes beyond alchemy and astrology. And if we do need to transcend science in some radical way, that certainly doesn't prove mind uploading is impossible. It just proves we have no idea what the hell is going on at this point in time, and we'd have to reevaluate everything at that point. And that's always possible. We could always find everything we know is rubbish, and we need to reevaluate everything. But I don't think the data at this point warrants making that assumption. I think the motivation for that is largely wishful thinking. People feel like their mind has something in it that must go beyond any possible machine or computer program in a profound sense. And because they have that feeling in their heart, they will grasp at straws to find any possible justification for it.
I'm going to just interject a note of skepticism here. In a minute, I think we're going to discuss the binding problem and why I'm personally skeptical that uploading is feasible and argue effectively that all we could ever create is zombies. But let's assume I'm completely wrong. Let's assume that Ben is right and it is possible faithfully to replicate the behavior of organic minds in a digital substrate. I'm going to make an analogy now. Now, imagine if I were to give you the moves, the gameplay of a game of chess I have just played. On the basis of that, you could faithfully replicate the game of chess, and yet at the same time, you would know nothing whatsoever of the textures of the pieces, or whether the pieces had any textures at all. Perhaps I was playing it online, and for textures of the pieces, substitute the particular textures of consciousness. If consciousness is causally impotent, if it doesn't play any kind of causal role, then it's very difficult to be confident if we do implement the functionality of our brains in silicon or so to speak, to upload ourselves, that the upload would have the same textures of consciousness or any at all. And that is, as I said, assuming that I'm wrong and it really is possible to upload ourselves. So that is, I don't think, purely idle skepticism. Ben, any thoughts?
Well, I suppose I just don't see a big difference between that and the endless series of other philosophical confusions about consciousness and identity. I mean, I wake up each morning, how do I know I'm the same person? How do I know my texture of consciousness today is the same as it was yesterday? Could I just be misremembering how I felt yesterday due to my perspective today being different? And I don't think we fully have resolved the basic issues regarding identity in everyday human life and the continuity of consciousness in everyday human life. And given that I can't prove to you that I feel the same today as I felt yesterday, how on earth could I ever prove I would feel the same if I were put in a robot body? So, I mean, of course we can't resolve that question, since it's based on all sorts of more profoundly unresolved issues. Of course, in the literature on mind uploading, people have proposed all sorts of continuous uploading methods, like upload one neuron at a time, upload in a way that lets you have some shared awareness with your uploaded mind. Then you could report and feel what that's like. It's like let's say that you create an upload and then you add some link into your brain where you could kind of share awareness with your upload for a while. Then you could feel whether it feels like you or not, or whether it's something strange and alien. But then you could always say, well, maybe that's an illusion, or maybe the contact with that uploaded mind makes your mind such that it is deluded to think that it's feeling the way it is. I mean, I feel like you just end up going down a bottomless hole of philosophical speculation about consciousness and identity, because we have no consistent philosophy of consciousness and identity to use as a ground for the discussion. And then I start to think about things like time. I mean, if you read the philosophy of time, it's totally confused. Philosophers don't have any decent idea what time is or how we get this feeling of an ongoing stream of time out of our rather disorganized and fluid individual temporal moments. But yet, the fact that we do not have a solid philosophical grounding for understanding what time is doesn't stop us from building machines that operate in time. And we do it all the time, and we don't worry about it. And I think uploading other consciousness technologies are the same way. You know, philosophy is not meant to arrive at answers. Philosophy is meant to spawn new questions from old questions, and we're spawning new questions about consciousness and time and space rapidly and fascinatingly. The fact that we will never resolve those questions doesn't stop us from building devices that utilize consciousness, time, and space, and so forth.
So let me follow that one up, Ben, then with the second objection, the big one that you guys promised to solve here tonight, which is that we'll never solve the the hard problem of consciousness. Are you saying that maybe we never will, but it won't matter?
Well, I think the hard problem of consciousness may become irrelevant in the sense that the problem of evil became irrelevant. I mean, if you go back and read Leibniz and a bunch of philosophers from hundreds of years ago, they're preoccupied with the problem of evil. Like, how could a totally good God who's powerful let bad things happen in the world? And we haven't really solved that problem now, but we kind of brush it aside because our paradigm changed. And the hard problem of consciousness is probably something like that. It's probably an indication that our paradigm for thinking about the mind is flawed. And the flaws in the paradigm have led us to this conundrum, just like the flaws in the Christian paradigm of that period a few hundred years ago led to the conundrum of the problem of evil. So yeah, I think it will be obsoleted rather than solved. I mean, I tend to be somewhat panpsychist in my perspective, meaning I think everything partakes of consciousness to some degree, which mutes the hard problem of consciousness to some extent, but doesn't solve all the problems of, say, why does a certain kind of experience correlate with a certain kind of cognitive or neural structure. So yeah, I don't think we need to solve or will solve that problem. I think we'll reframe our understanding of the mind in a way that problem appears uninteresting.
Okay, well, we'll come back to panpsychism in a couple minutes. What do you think, David, about the hard problem of consciousness? Is consciousness something that can be ultimately quantified, understood, or will we, as Ben says, shift paradigms and have other things we're focused on in the future, and this won't be an issue?
Oh, I think ultimately it will be rigorously, quantitatively understood. First, I'm going to say something that I think Ben will actually probably agree with. I think a constraint on any satisfactory theory of the world is that it must be consistent with reductive physicalism. By physicalism, I mean that essentially the equations of physics and their solutions exhaustively describe the world. There should be no element in reality that is not captured in the formalism of physics and its solutions. Now, Ben touches on panpsychism, which intuitively is inconsistent with physicalism, but in fact it is possible to be both and panpsychist and a reductive physicalist, because the fundamental entities that physics deals with, most notably a field, are defined purely mathematically, i.e. physics doesn't disclose the intrinsic nature of the stuff of the world. It simply describes exhaustively the behavior. Now, is this a satisfactory resolution of the hard problem of consciousness? Unfortunately, to my mind, no. It's a precondition of a solution, because simply assuming that consciousness is fundamental to sticks, stones, and yes, digital computers, doesn't explain why a stone or a tree or a rock, or I would argue a digital computer, is not a subjective experience. And here's an analogy. Consider the population of China. Individual skull-bound Chinese minds, however they configure themselves, are never going to be configured into a single subjective experience. And here is the big question to my mind. How is it that 85 billion odd membrane-bound, apparently classical neurons can generate bound phenomenal objects and unitary subjects of experience like you or me? This is the binding problem we're going to come to in a minute. To my mind, the way organic minds over the past half billion years solved the binding problem is the greatest cognitive achievement of biological minds. How we do so is unknown, or at least extremely conjectural, and this I regard as the fundamental challenge. I think, yes, a lot of people assume that if we're bold enough to posit panpsychism or something like it as a scientifically literate form of panpsychism, then somehow we've dissolved the problem of consciousness and uploading is feasible. I think, personally, it's merely the precondition of any solution.
Yeah, well, I mean, I agree that panpsychism in itself does not solve all problems in the philosophy of consciousness. I think it is at least a consistent and sensible basis from which to begin thinking about how consciousness relates to the world, whereas dualism and pure reductionism seem to me not even to make sense, so I don't even consider them valid starting points for thinking about how consciousness and the world relate. I mean, as you probably know, the philosopher Galen Strawson has written a bunch of philosophical texts arguing that physicalism entails panpsychism, that if you hold everything is physical, then you must hold that everything is mind to some extent. And again, that brings us very deep down some philosophical rabbit holes, which I don't think these issues will ever be fully resolved any more than the philosophy of space, time, or beauty has been resolved. And I just think, you know, when Picasso painted Guernica, he did not have to have a consistent and complete theory of beauty before making that beautiful painting. And before we make a conscious machine or a conscious mind upload, we don't have to have a complete, consistent theory of consciousness. These abstract theories that we formulate can guide our practical work, but in the end, the practical work is what it is, irrespective of the shifting theoretical frameworks we use to describe it.
I take Strawsonian physicalism very seriously. I would just say that I would personally guess, and it's no more than a guess, that in principle it will be possible to read the precise values and textures of consciousness off the solutions to the fundamental equations of physics. Now, we don't have anything like the Rosetta Stone that would enable us to do so, but if one is a physicalist, there is nothing in the world that is not captured in the fundamental formalism. So perhaps I'm less pessimistic than Ben here.
I think that we could come up with a very strong theory of the physical correlates of conscious experience. Once physics and the science of complex systems and neuroscience have advanced more fully, and the extent to which that captures everything that's interesting about experience, I'm unsure of. I guess I have an inkling that the way we think about science may need to be expanded in the future, and it's possible that looking at finite sets of finite precision observations may not end up being the right paradigm to use to think about modeling the universe. I mean, I was much inspired by the Buddhist logicians from a few hundred years ago. I mean, they had their own very complex theory of the mind and consciousness, which was formed not by data gathering, but by a group of people basically introspecting into their own minds, following a certain discipline, and then arriving at an agreement about basically the ontology of experience, Dharmakirti, Dignaga, and these medieval Buddhist philosophers of mind. And I wonder if in the future we won't have a science of mind which involves a combination of current experimental science and some sort of shared introspection, such as the Buddhist philosophers did. But rather than being an objection to mind uploading, I think that mind uploading will be an amazing way to advance a new kind of science of mind. I mean, imagine comparing subjective experiential observations with various uploads of yourself in various different substrates or in various versions of yourself halfway between one substrate and another. I mean, I think the combination of empirical scientific measurement of these sorts of situations with subjective comparison of experiential observations of minds in these various conditions of uploading, that really should be quite fascinating. And, you know, after we've had mind uploads for a while and have done a lot of tests on them, both experientially and empirically, then we may actually get a theory of mind uploading in a form we can't imagine now. But right now, we're really struggling to describe this. But, I mean, that's just like saying we're struggling to describe other galaxies before we have flown there. The fact that we don't know what's going on there doesn't mean we can't fly there and find out.
Okay, fair enough. Stephen, you had something you wanted to say.
Yeah, it seems to me that what we might be looking at here is the dichotomy or the tension between scientists and engineers. Scientists are never happy with incomplete knowledge about anything, including consciousness. But engineers, they don't let incomplete knowledge stand between themselves and something, a practical breakthrough.
Actually accomplishing something, right, yeah.
Yeah, you know, for example, Wright brothers had very incomplete knowledge, of course, of aeronautics. They knew just enough to get off the ground. And then the scientists sort of had to play catch up after that, explaining what it is that they were doing. And so I think the idea that we may see conscious computers and later figure out exactly what's going on and create a theory to cover it. There's precedence for that sort of thing.
David, Ben, thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I said I feel myself in somewhat anomalous position of being a panpsychist who is also skeptical that digital computers will ever have unitary minds. Intuitively, panpsychists tend to overpopulate the world with minds, but we're not animists. And just as both Ben and I would, of course, agree that sticks, stones, and trees don't have minds, where we would disagree is whether classical digital computers are capable of supporting unitary minds. Now, I don't know which on the list is the binding problem, but I think we're going to go on to that a bit later, are we? I'm not sure.
Let's take it. Let's hit the binding problem now. I think we're ready. Go ahead.
Who is going to, just in case any of the audience haven't encountered the binding problem before, who's going to provide an introduction?
I will just note that that is the actually it's the next item on the list, and in fact at the rate we're going, we're gonna have to speed up how quickly we're moving through these. But what George wrote was even if we do figure out how the brain generates subjective experience, classical digital computers may never be able to support unitary phenomenal minds. This is what's referred to as the binding problem, our inability to understand how a mind is able to segregate elements and combine problems as seamlessly as it does. Needless to say, we don't even know if a Turing machine can even support these functions. So that's the binding problem in a nutshell. And let me just ask you, David, based on what you just said earlier, if ultimately consciousness is something that we can quantify, and if it all comes down to physics in the end, wouldn't this just be a really hard math problem that we have to solve? Isn't this just another little, particle yet to be discovered, as it were? I mean, it's just part of the mix. Why would this be an intractable problem?
There are two separate questions here. First, purely considering the abstract with infinite computational resources, is there some kind of abstract classical Turing machine that could replicate the behavior of you or me, then the answer is yes. But there's also the question, is it possible to actually build a classical digital computer that supports both bound phenomenal objects and a unitary self? And by bound, I mean, if you think of the way that in the mind-brain, distributively or apparently distributively processed edges, textures, motions, somehow the mind-brain turns them into unitary experiential objects embedded in a unitary world simulation. Right now, for instance, you could be listening to a symphony, admiring a beautiful sunset, seeing a dozen people somehow in almost real time. The mind brain constructs this simulation. And how it's possible to do this, why we're not just patterns of mind dust, is highly speculative. Because even, as I said, even if one is prepared to assume some kind of panpsychism, how is it that these discrete psychons or atoms can combine into unitary experiential objects? And it's worth, well, one way of appreciating perhaps the computational power of object binding and the unity of the self is to look at neurological syndromes where they break down. Something like, is a fancy name, simultaneognosia. People with simultaneognosia can literally only see one thing at once, which is very debilitating. Or motion blindness. Someone with motion blindness, I mean, they'll see a car in one place, then the car 10 meters in front of them, then the car 10 meters. Extraordinarily powerful. Or, to give another example, perhaps something like florid schizophrenia. How does the mind brain do it? Well, we could go into different speculations here, but the honest answer is, no one knows. Perhaps I could then, pass the buck to Ben. I think Ben would probably regard the binding problem as just another technical problem that neuroscanning will solve.
I think that the binding problem reduces to a science problem of understanding the particulars of human neurodynamics, and then B, the hard problem of consciousness rearing its ugly head again. So I think that the neurodynamic problem is how can all these disparate patterns in the brain related to a given percept or concept, how can they all be unified together into some whole? And I think that nonlinear dynamics gives us a very clear sense of how this can happen. If you look at the simulations of chunks of cortex done by Izhukevich and Edelman. I mean, they simulated large collections of Izhukevich neurons, and you find in these large simulations of millions of neurons, you find these coherent wave patterns that bind together neurons in distant parts of the simulated brain into a coherent, holistic pattern using the slow moving dynamic associated with the Hodgkin-Huxley equation. I mean, so I really see that nonlinear dynamics in neural networks can give rise to, you know, unity arriving from disparate pieces. And we don't understand all of the aspects of that yet, because we don't understand all of how the brain works yet. I mean, we don't know that much about the roles of glia. We don't know that much about what the charge diffusion through the extracellular matrix is doing. There's a lot of unknowns. But I see no reason why this isn't just a science problem of the nonlinear dynamics of the brain. Then you have the hard problem of consciousness rearing its head, and we say, but I have this feeling of unity. Where does this feeling of unity come from? And then, okay, there's a gap between the feeling of unity in your conscious experience and then the physical or dynamical unity of some strange attractor emerging in the nonlinear neuronal glial network of the brain. But that explanatory gap, again, that's a hard problem of consciousness thing. How does the feeling come out of what's going on in the underlying system? So I don't see anything there but hard science and then the hard problem of consciousness. I don't see anything that jumps out at me like, no, we can't solve that. Of course, any problem could be unsolvable until you've solved it. And if someone wants to say it's unsolvable, then how do you argue with them? It's the same thing as with nanotechnology. I mean, Smalley and these guys told Eric Drexler, no, we can't build things that small because a problem will emerge. And what do? You say, okay, you know, you have it your way, I'll have it the right way. And then you proceed and you build something that small, and then they shut up.
Go ahead, David. It's fine. I was just going to say, back to my the analogy with the population of China again. However you connect spellbound Chinese minds, however they are connected, you are not going to obtain a unitary subject of experience or bound phenomenal objects. Now, someone in response to this might say, well, how do you know that the population of China isn't a subject of experience? Or how do I know that arranged in the right way, it wouldn't be possible to generate experiential perceptual objects? And the answer is I don't. But if it were the case that somehow configuring the population of China in the right way generated a unitary subject, this would be a failure of reductive physicalism, and I regard any satisfactory theory must be consistent with reductive physicalism on pain of some kind of dualism. Now, what then could potentially explain what I regard as classically inexplicable? Well, I confess I'm in the quantum mind camp. I think macroscopic quantum coherence can potentially explain bound perceptual objects and the unity, the synchronic unity of the self. Now, there are very powerful arguments against this, most notably by physicist Max Tegmark, who will argue that in an environment as warm and noisy as the brain, something like essentially this kind of exotic quantum phenomenon will break down, that essentially thermally induced decoherence would destroy these forms of exotic quantum coherence in ridiculously short intervals. Now, I regard there are counter-arguments to this, even assuming that Max Tegmark is correct, even if it were the case that thermally induced decoherence washes out these effects within a ridiculously short sub-picosecond timescale, I still think this potentially offers a way to explain what is classically inexplicable. However, I can imagine at least some of your scientifically literate audience rolling their eyes here, and my heart sinks too when anyone mentions the words quantum consciousness. I think if we are to aim for both reductive physicalism and a solution to the binding problem, then some pretty exotic solutions are going to be needed. And I know Ben will probably strongly disagree with me here.
Well, if I could just jump in for a minute, it seems to me that to Ben, to your point, if that's true, if we have this exotic quantum thing going on in our heads, and that's what consciousness is, and that's what's enabling binding to occur, and so forth, then that's the scientific problem that that has to be solved. That that the fact that it's that doesn't therefore make it beyond the realm of that which could be ultimately understood. Is that fair to say?
Well, I mean, I take a somewhat different view of that, and this gets into a whole bunch of deep issues that would overspill our time. But I think if you look at the work of Dirk Eretz at the Free University of Brussels and Harold Oppenspacher, you see that quantum versus classical is somewhat a matter of the relation between the observing system and the observed system. So there are many cases where quantum math is actually what you want to use to model a system you would typically consider classical, like a system involving water going around in tubes or something. So I think that if a quantum perspective is needed to understand consciousness in some sense, this doesn't necessarily imply that consciousness can't be associated with a computational system. The quantumness of a system has to do with who is observing it and what is their practical ability to measure it. So that gets us pretty deep into the philosophy of quantum measurement and so on. We don't really have time to go there. So I guess as a short summary, I would say there are a lot of unresolved things in the foundations of quantum mechanics and the quantum theory of measurement, which probably tie in with many unresolved things in the theory of consciousness. And these are all very interesting things to work on and to think about. And I don't think our own ignorance and confusion about these things is an objection to uploading into digital computers. Now, if it were an objection, if I'm wrong, and you really do need a quantum computer to create a human-like intelligence, I doubt it, but it's not impossible. If that is true, okay, I mean, D-Wave has already built an adiabatic quantum computer and is using that for some small-scale practical problems. So, you know, that will delay mind up learning by a couple decades while D-Wave or some other company builds a more general-purpose quantum computer, and then we upload into that. I mean, that's not really an objection. I mean, what Penrose and Hameroff were claiming is not just that the brain requires a quantum computer, but that the brain requires some kind of fictional quantum gravity computer that uses some fictional non-computable quantum gravity theory. And that's just a fairy tale. On the other hand, could we need a quantum computer? Sure, we could. Then we'll build one, and then we can upload into that. And then the robot Van Goethe walking around in the street will have a quantum positronic brain, a la Isaac Asimov in its head, rather than a digital computer brain. That doesn't change the big picture at all. That's merely a minor technical detail.
Ooh, I'm not sure it's merely a minor technical detail, because if a classical digital computer can simulate both the behavior and the phenomenology of our minds, essentially it's possible for people and minds to exist at different levels of computational abstraction, whereas if generating unitary mind, solving the binding problem, involves tapping into the world's fundamental quantum substrate, then that's a very different scenario.
To our two guests, Bill. Assuming, David, that it is possible at all to one day upload a mind, would you think that an artificial intelligence would be a necessary prerequisite? In other words, would we need the help of artificial intelligences in order to make the jump?
Good heavens. I personally feel that it's going to need a conceptual breakthrough, a conceptual revolution before we can even contemplate something like uploading. Now, the idea of so-called whole brain emulation is the idea that it would be possible to finesse our ignorance, that even in the absence of any understanding of why consciousness, crania exist, they have the particular textures they do, or a solution to the binding problem, it will nonetheless be possible for us to in some sense, upload ourselves. Now, I am just extremely skeptical that this is going to be possible. We don't even know what is and isn't substrate, what is functionally relevant and what is computationally incidental. Essentially, I would argue for an extremely fine-grained functionalism. Many researchers in the field would argue for a much coarser-grained functionalism. AGI, good heavens, raises a whole host of issues. I'm sure you've probably tackled them already, but I'm not going to go into them here unless invited to do so.
I don't think we necessarily require an artificial general intelligence in order to do mind uploading. I mean, I think what we need most critically is brain scanning with much higher spatial and temporal resolution, and then we can scan the brain. We can put someone's brain in a program that's controlling a robot body, and then you will have uploads walking around. And then the philosophers and George Dvorsky can argue with the mind uploading a robot about whether it's conscious or not. And, you know, Dvorsky will say, "Robot, you're not conscious." And the robot will say, "Dvorsky, you're not conscious." And that will be funny for a couple of years. And people will get over it and just accept that the uploads are just as conscious as everybody else. Could you get that breakthrough in spatial and temporal high-resolution brain scanning and the breakthroughs in low-cost, massively powerful computing and the breakthroughs in human-like robotics faster if you had AGI scientists helping with that science. Yeah, of course you could. So, of course, having an AGI scientist first would accelerate pretty much everything, but I don't see why it would be critical for this. I think we need breakthroughs in brain imaging, but I think humans have come up with plenty of breakthroughs before, and I have faith we could do it again, although predicting exactly when a breakthrough will come is something not even the amazing Ray Kurzweil has been entirely successful at.
Well, Ben, one small clarification on what you just said. I generally agree with you, but the scenario where the robot is having the debate with Dvorsky, he would actually have to get Dvorsky to come on his show in order to have that robot that debate with him. That
well, this robot may be more powerful than you are. So
I should hope that he is. Okay, so listen, we're down to about 5 minutes, and we've still got three of these to go. So we're going to hit these really fast, guys. I think we've danced around them anyway. But we've talked a little bit about panpsychism. As far as that being an objection, it seems to me that the objection amounts to this, because I think both sides have both of you gentlemen have had a chance to say something about panpsychism, assuming that there's some truth to that, and that there is this grain of sentience that is inherent in physical matter, then it just becomes a matter of whether consciousness can be attached to certain substrates in certain configurations. It's not a matter of the fact that panpsychism in and of itself would prevent it. It's a matter of you've got this complicated issue of what that field is and how it's being promulgated within a digital environment versus within our actual environment. Is that a fair way of summarizing the problem with panpsychism, David?
Well, as I said, I personally take Strawsonian physicalism or that form of scientifically literate panpsychism very seriously indeed. But I think what we're calling mind uploading, all one is ever going to do is produce zombies. Ben would disagree here. This is back to the binding problem again.
Okay.
Well, do you consider there's any test you could use to validate whether it was a zombie or not?
I think, you see, I mean, some of us at least spend much of our time thinking about issues of consciousness, perhaps trying to establish the neural correlates of consciousness. And it is very difficult to see how, let's say, a classical digital computer investigating, trying to map out the neural correlates of consciousness, how it would do so, how it could be programmed to do so. I'm using the language of programming here. If it's a so-called neural net or connectionless system, how it could be trained up to do so. This isn't the perhaps rather uninteresting question of when, let's say, a computer wins at Jeopardy or Deep Blue plays at chess, whether that computer is conscious or not. The question is, when investigating issues of consciousness and object binding, what at least naively is a non-sentient system can perform the investigation in the way that you or I can. And it isn't just a philosopher's question. You get someone like Christoph Koch and his colleagues investigating the neural correlates of consciousness. Yes, I am extremely cautious here. I mean, it's worth considering, for instance, that even today, a little bumblebee, for instance, with a nervous system of perhaps less than a million neurons, is far more computationally sophisticated than anything that DARPA can come up with. So precisely how far one can go with a classical architecture, I just have to obviously say, I don't know.
What about this possibility, Ben? If it was a zombie, if you uploaded a mind and it was a zombie, is it possible that zombie would tell you? It would say, Well, I don't know what the hell's going on, but this is not consciousness the way I remember it. You know, because say it's an uploaded version of me. I know I'm conscious, right? So if there's some new version of me that's not, would it possibly subjectively feel the difference?
Well, no, you're just tying yourself in philosophical knots. I mean, the notion of a philosophical zombie, as you read in the academic philosophy literature, would be something that was behaviorally identical, but didn't have any experience. Now, what you're saying is an upload that said, well, this doesn't feel right. This doesn't feel like consciousness.
Right.
You know, but
no,
then
so it would be
in order to be able to sense this doesn't feel right, then what that means is, yes, it's conscious, but it's just a hack job, right? It didn't work well. Like, oh,
right.
Man,
yeah, right.
I have a bad headache and I feel like an idiot and this is no fun. Put me back in my human body. You know, that may well be what the first upload is like, ah, this sucks, put me back, no, and then you go back and you adjust the process a bit, but that then becomes probably more of an engineering and debugging problem than this foundational problem that the non-empirical spark of consciousness is not there. Well, I guess what perplexes me with David's argument, which we may not have time to get into, is he seems to think that some kind of quantum element is needed to make a machine conscious. But it's not clear to me if he thinks that means a digital emulation of a human mind would be behaviorally inadequate. Because, I mean, one possibility is, okay, you need a quantum computer to make a human-like mind. Therefore, anything you do...
Hello, Ben.
And answers when you ask questions, and you need a quantum computer, and then that's fairly straightforward. That doesn't involve any weird philosophy questions, right? The weird philosophy questions is where, yes, the upload acts exactly like Phil. It talks exactly like Phil. It walks like Phil, right? It runs up and down like Phil, but it has no experience. But there's no way to tell. So sentience has replaced itself with behaviorally identical non-sentience, and that I think is a bullshit concept, to be frank, but it's kind of amusing, and that's what the philosophers have killed millions of trees writing about.
Well, I think what one wants to do is to be able rigorously to derive macro phenomenology, phenomenal chairs, tables, unitary self, world simulations from the underlying microphenomenology. Both Ben and I, as I said, ultimately we take very seriously panpsychism, Strawsonian physicalism. How is it possible, in principle, to do this rigorous derivation? I'm, as a philosopher, aren't supposed to make predictions, but I would make a prediction that if and when our apparatus allows us to get down to sub-picosecond intervals, it will be possible on interrogating the mind-brain to recover the formal shadows of macroscopic objects, tables, chairs, in our world simulations, i.e. there will be a perfect structural match between phenomenology and the formal properties of mind, whereas standardly one would be told no at this kind of level. One would find simply quantum psychotic noise in the same way as in your CPU of your desktop computer. You just get noise at that kind of level.
Okay, well, there's you know, since we were talking about me, all right, there's no way a zombie is pulling all this off. Okay, I'm just going to leave it at that. That's the that's
prove it.
That's
prove,
the
prove,
yeah.
Prove
it.
Prove your
prove
conscious.
It.
You have, prove,
okay,
prove your conscious in 25 words or less.
We're completely out of time, unfortunately, and we don't have time to delve into mind-body dualism being true, although I think we sort of touched on that with the first one. The one area where I would want to take that, if we could take it just real fast, and each of you give me 30 seconds on this, what if we're living in a simulation and mind-body dualism is true for that reason? Would that therefore make uploading extremely difficult or impossible? Ben.
Well, if we are living in a simulation, the question is what kind of simulation it is. Of course, if we are living in a computer simulation, then most of these objections go away because we are already digital beings. So putting ourselves into a virtual machine running inside the digital machine we're already running on would seem conceptually unproblematic. I mean, if we're living in a quantum computer simulation, I guess you might need a quantum computer within the simulation. But really, this just gets so far.
Okay, that's your 30 seconds. Go ahead, David.
What can you say?
Well, I would say that agony or bliss is absolutely real, that it doesn't make sense to speak of if you are right now undergoing agony or, I hope, extreme happiness or joy, that in some sense it is any less real for being notionally a simulation. But the so-called simulation hypothesis and simulation argument really is a topic for another night.
Indeed. Well, I can only tell you that the happiness I'm feeling is very real. Nothing makes me happier than having a discussion like this with two great guests like you, and nothing makes me sadder than having to cut this short. But unfortunately, we are completely out of time, gentlemen. I thank you both for being with us, and I hope we'll be able to do this again sometime in the very near future.
Thank you very much for having us.
I mean, you're one of my favorite zombies.
Thanks, Ben. Stephen, what's our music this evening?
Well, I just want to say, Bill, you know, when you are uploaded, if you're not eating brains, I'm going to say you're not a zombie. Okay,
that's fair enough. There,
that's my modified touring test for uploaded Phil. Okay. the music tonight is Good Side by Greta Gaines.
Good Side by Greta Gaines. Thanks for putting that together. Stephen, thanks once again to our guests and for all of you for participating in this week's Fast Forward, The World Transformed. We'll be back again at the regular time next week. And until next time, live to see it.
I'd like to get on your good side. I'd like to be there when you wake up. I'd like to get on your good side. Make a little love before we break up. I see it coming like a storm cloud, rolling across the mad crowd, turning on me. While you were living on a high road, I took a low down and delicately. Cruising the pastures, living on last year's inventory. But I gotta tell you, you're still the fella that does it for me. I'd like to get on your good side. I'd like to be there when you wake up. I'd like to get on your good side. Get on your good.